Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Saturday, July 19th, 2003. Today's session is entitled A Refiner's Fire, Session 5 of Poetry and the Healing Power of Salvage and Detritus, presented by Steve Ringo, number RIS 2003-05. Let's listen in.
Steve Ringo is my name. You can burn it, Bob. And this is Session 5 of 5. Under the title, Poetry as a Healing Power of Salvage and Detritus. On Monday, I showed about 30 slides from some creations I've been creating with absolutely no pretensions at all toward ambition or money or renown, just because this thing started to want to come out of me and I started making stuff, mainly because my wife's an art teacher and she found that vein in me that she could tickle and prod, and then it started coming out. Now she doesn't know how to stop it. So
I don't try.
The text for today is, and the title of this session is A Refiner's Fire. And if you would turn in the back, the second page from the very back, there's a passage from Isaiah that I'd like to read to get us started. And then there's a passage from Malachi, which I have the same passage from Malachi pulled out of Handel's Messiah that I'm going to play to you while we see the slides. So that keeps me from talking ad nauseum during the slides. So I will read this one about the blacksmith. See, it is I who created the blacksmith, who fans the coals into flame and forges a weapon fit for its work. It is I who have created the destroyer to work havoc. No weapon forged against you will prevail, and you will refute every tongue that accuses you. This is the heritage of the servants of the Lord. Okay. Slides and lights. Thank you, Bretta. Thank you, Noah.
And then Malachi is going to be in the music.
Yeah, if you want to read along, you can, or just watch the slides. It's A Refiner's Fire.
Thank you. Calhoun.
You could probably see some indications of fire in there. The burned out fuse, the spark plugs, all sorts of, several of those items were found from a site of an actual fire at a transmission shop in Spokane. So fire, and then the blacksmith passage from Isaiah, the refiner's fire from Malachi. The blacksmith uses both the hammer and the fire, it's forging. It's an image that's found all over the scriptures. So that's it to introduce the theme. And obvious, and maybe it's obvious, that we're stating that refining and healing maybe isn't a great leap. That when we go through that refiner's fire in life, whether it's like marriage and family and divorce and struggles with our children or grandchildren or whatever, then those are fires we pass through. And with God and with the Lord, then the healing, you know, how does that happen? And it is quite mysterious. I think that poetry is one of the vehicles for understanding it because it's so mysterious. And that's the goal of, or one of the goals. And if there are other spin-offs, that's great too, of course, as poetry is prone to do. Let's start with, flip back toward the beginning there, and we'll jump in on the first poem by Scott Cairns. If some of you missed out, each session, almost every session we've done here has had a Scott Cairns poem in it. It was the faculty member who was hired by the English faculty at Seattle Pacific University about a year and a half ago or so. And quickly, just before, after he signed a contract, the contract was negated, he was fired and asked to leave and never taught a class, kind of like the Mike Price thing at Alabama, one could say. But not really. They had found some erotic poems about God, where God and humankind were both, I guess it was too erotic for Seattle Pacific University. And a very theological poet and very Christian poet. I really admire his poetry because of the way he takes Christian themes directly into his poetry and yet has stayed in the mainstream of modern poetry. So, having given that little intro that I touched on earlier, I would like to read the first one here, The End of Heaven and the End of Hell. At long last, the feeble fretwork tumbles, apart forever, and you stand alone, unprotected, undeceived, in fullness. And we are all there as well, equally alone. And equally full of ourselves. Yes, I believe ourselves is what we then become, though what that is must surprise each trembling figure. And in horror or elation, the effect will be the same, humility. One of two discrete sorts, perhaps, but genuine humility. And that long record of our choices, your every choice, is itself the final body, the eternal dress. And of course, there extends before us, finally, a measure we can recognize. We see his face, and we see ourselves, and flee. And shame, old familiar, will sustain that flight, unchecked. Or the ghost, forgotten just now, merest spark at the center will flare, bid us turn, and flame unto a last consuming light. His light, our light, caught at last together as a single brilliance, extravagant, compounding awful glories as we burn. The refiner's fire comes in there at the end. It's hard to write a poem or anything about the end of heaven and the end of hell. That's a pretty tough one, huh? Mm-hmm. And you would have to rely on images, and it would lead you to some abstraction. What are some of the things you think he might be saying or might be getting at, or what are some of the images you may like or find intriguing or whatnot? What might be a good starting point for you?
That long record of our choices is the final body.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Say some more about that.
Well, just a picture of, you know, what happens at the end, and what we're filled with, he says, is ourselves. We become fully ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, at least the body, the dress,
yeah,
is the series of choices we've made.
Yeah.
We sometimes like to think that we get away from all of the bad choices.
Right, that's kind of canceled.
His picture is, it's all part of...
It shaped us to be our genuine self.
Yeah.
Yeah, even afterwards.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a communality in here, too, that ourselves is even capitalized. That we is quite paramount and crucial, that it's a we. But then they are the genuine person, too. Genuine humility, eternal dress, yeah.
What do you take of the two discrete sorts? We have the same humility, one of two discrete sorts, perhaps, but genuine humility.
Yeah, I don't know.
Is that the humility of humbled by one's weaknesses?
Yeah.
Or in the other one, humbled in the face of...
Mm-hmm.
Eternal God.
Yeah. Could be internal and external, or I don't know. I'm not sure he gives us.
I don't think he goes on to say that. I was looking for it. Yeah. I thought the two discrete sorts would show up.
Yeah, I don't know. We see his face and see ourselves.
See ourselves. Yeah, maybe that's the two.
Could be. And what? Flee. Mm-hmm. I like the word flee, kind of catches you too.
Mm-hmm.
And then the turning. We've seen in several of the poems we've looked at the turning, whether that's a turning away from her loved ones like Mara did, moving toward back to the Sodom and Gomorrah picture of destruction, or a turning in the Robert Bly poem where, you know, these little turns we make toward someone or away from someone, or toward a future, or away from a future, which all add up to those choices that you touched on too, Maureen. I like to start here because of the fire imagery, but also because it starts at heaven and hell, which is usually the ending point. I wanted to start at the end and then move sort of back toward the earth. Also because of the Handel, the Messiah piece was a kind of eschatological or end of times, and it's a piece that's often used at Advent, talking about that second and final coming, or the end times. So I think that was a way I wanted to try to start it off. Who would like to read Scott Cairns' next poem there on the next page? Anybody?
I'll try.
Please, Martin.
Sacraments. Doubtless, grace is involved. When is it not? But its locus is uncertain. Remains the cardinal catch whenever we dare interrogate again our sacramental dogma. After all, grace may lie contracted, inaccessible in Yahweh's ancient vault. And it could be these painstakingly enacted tokens of mystery are really about as good as paper money. But what if even the troubled air we breathe were drenched above our knowing with the golden balm of Adonai? Well, I like to get carried away. Never mind. The weary, Never mind the weary questions of which and how many dear rituals may qualify. The dire attributes of divine participation are what these days could stand some specifics, or, say, a little more dogmatic elucidation. For it may be some dreadful portion. Very God of very God, makes periodic and discreet returns, piecemeal, sabbatical visitation to a matter and a territory absence to suffer our mutual and, let's face it, flagging venture. But who knows? The holy may flourish any form figuring the self's diminishment, any conjunctive ebbing which yields a reply.
This language is a little more academic and highfalutin. He doesn't use all the words that we've seen in some of his poems that are more down to earth. But the title again gives you a clue, sacraments, an abstract thought connected to a visible or tangible form. I think the refining imagery comes there near the end, the mutual, let's face it, flagging venture then. But who knows, the holy may flourish any form, figuring the self's diminishment. It brought to mind for me the first time I read this, the Grunewald painting where John the Baptist is tiny, real small, pointing at Jesus on the cross. And then at the bottom, doesn't it say, I think it's either written on the canvas or in the title of the piece, he must increase and I must decrease. And John's a small figure, but his hand is big, his bigger. So the whole point is not me. That's that humility again. Maybe I must decrease in order to grow. I must decrease in order to flourish. I must ebb away, he uses the word ebb, in order to heal and to become part of this. It's very much, it's an AA thing in a lot of ways. Letting go of the self in order to find the self. There are sociologists who say the AA way is the most significant religious contribution of the 20th century to religion. That whole creed, and it's very theological as well, and very Christian in many ways, I think. That would be a whole other discussion, but he talks about these fragments and these shy, kind of mouse-like little things that piecemeal come together to make this holiness happen. And like we've looked at, each time we've come, I've brought some of the junk that's been discovered up at the mine here, and things you see on those slides, that God reclaims these the same way he reclaims the whole creation. People have become so human-centered in what salvation means, and we touched on that in the third session, that salvation is people. When really, doesn't it talk in Revelation about the redemption of the whole creation, the whole created order? The Creator's stuff, if you will. Other thoughts on this one? I don't want to dwell too long on this one, but...
In that sentence at the end, the holy may flourish any form figuring the self's diminishment. Does that mean make cause to flourish, sort of? Is that how he's using that?
I take it that way, but it could be...
Just a different word, use of that, right?
Yeah, it's whether he's just economizing or whether he means to give it a little... The verb has more of a burden than it might have without some assistance, right? The holy may flourish. It sounds like maybe because he wants to personify the holy, I don't know, make it more active or something. Mm-hmm. He must increase, I must decrease. I like that connection too. But
I don't think that the holy is not causing something else, but the holy is flourishing.
Right?
So
the holy itself may flourish, yeah. Not that the holy flourishes something else. Holy may flourish in any form then, kind of. Yeah. Do the results of those two lead to a different place, or are they kind of getting you to the same place anyway? That's another question maybe could be asked. Does that make sense? From what Maurice said about flourish and from what you said?
Yeah.
Well, I you know, when the holy becomes visible one way or another,
yeah,
it causes diminishment.
There you go. Mm-hmm. It's building, yeah, back to the ebb. It flourishes because I am.
Gladly.
Yeah. Right. Good. Let's move to the next one. Actually, I want to. Yeah, let's do this one. Okay. Ode to the Bed. We looked at an erudite poem about the dictionary last, maybe a couple times ago. Ode to the Bed. We go from one bed to the next in this journey, life's journey. The newborn, the afflicted, the dying, the lover and the dreamer alike. They arrived and they will depart by bed. We have all arrived and we will all depart on this train, on this boat, down this river, which is common to all life, which is shared by each and every death. Love makes the earth a bed for blooming, mired in blood. The fullness of September, its clarity shaken out in sheets by the skyfall, drying. The sea groans, battered by the green vault of the abyss, surging in white clothes and black. O sea, intimidating bed, death and life writhing endlessly, and savage air and spray. Fish sleep deep inside you, and the night, and whales. In you rest the celestial centrifugal ashes of dying meteors. You throb, sea, with the life of everything that sleeps within you. You build up and tear down the ever-renewed bride's bed of dreams. Lightning flashes suddenly in two eyes of pure forget-me-not and an ivory or apple profile. It shows you the way to soft sheets, like bright banners, white lilies, down which we roll to the final embrace. Then death slips into bed with us, with his spotted hands and iodine tongue. He raises a finger as long as a long road, showing us the shore, the gateway to our dying pain. What kinds of refining are in there? Not much of the fire type, but I think there's a lot of action that's refining in here too. What do you think? Or what do you like? Or what jumps out at you? Lightning would be one of the fires. And I think in the just a section above where it says lightning there, it would be the O.C. intimidating bed, death and life, writhing endlessly. It has a sexual sort of sensibility to it. I think that death and life are almost sexually writhing in an interesting way of that union, that kind of merging of life and death. The fish sleep in you, the whales, the rest. And then the centrifugal spinning out of all these ashes and dying meteors, there's some fire there. And the throb, the life of everything that sleeps within you. And sleep, death, life, power, every day rising, that little death, overcoming that, waking up, the sun. There's many religions have gone with this one, and I don't think this poem is specifically Christian at all. Neruda would have had Catholic underpinnings, but it's not a concern really of his very often. What do you think? I want to hear you.
Almost everything is a bed.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, yeah, it's the locus of the kind of passion that reveals life and reveals death. And whether it's the sea or whether it's the monk or whether it's a flower or whether it's a person.
said that. It's beautiful. That really, the way he's doing it here, everything around us, you could make your own poem with the bed as the metaphor, where everything is a bed. I like that. Do you agree? Or you can you go with that? Agree, so didactic.
Interesting the way death slips into bed with us.
Yeah.
It's a little bit horrific with the spotted hands and iodine tongue.
Right.
But then he raises that long finger.
Yeah.
And it's almost a gentle gateway to our dying pain.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not sweet, but it's not. Yeah.
Yeah. It
just something else. Something new, I guess for sure it's new. Yeah. I like that part. That's probably my favorite part of the poem too, the when death slips into bed with us.
I've noticed this before, but the lightning flashes show you the way. Is this right?
Mm-hmm.
It shows you the way. Lightning, yeah, lightning shows you the way, and this finger of death shows you the way. So there's a some direction,
guidance
here.
From the beginning of the poem, it's the journey too. We go from one bed to the next in this journey, life's journey. But like you said, what's your name?
Dean.
With an N?
Yeah.
Thank you. Like Dean said, that everything becomes a bed, every step of the journey, if you want to see it that way, can be seen as the bed. The fullness of September, I like that kind of thing. Let's move to the bottom of the next page, and then we'll go upward to the poem after that. Someone want to read Mirza Ghalib from the 19th century, Muslim poet? Okay.
I am not a flower of song, nor any of the bright shuttles of music. I am the sound of my own breaking. You think of how your hair looks. I think of the ends of things. We think we know our own minds, but our hearts are children. Now that you have appeared to me, I bow. May you be blessed. You look after the wretched. No wonder you came looking for me.
He was influenced by the 14th or 13th century poet who wrote the Ghazal form. If you know the Ghazals, it's G-H-A-Z-A-L. And the Ghazal is usually three lines, which are kind of a Middle Eastern or Arabic haiku. And the Ghazal starts with one line that's a simple, terse statement. The second statement is something altogether weird or different and turns the first statement on its ear. And the third one blends this first two. It's called the Ghazal. It's very kind of a cryptic but jigsaw puzzle-ish thing that you kind of have to figure out. Mind exercise or whatnot. But this poet, Mirza Ghalib, was influenced by that Ghazal form. You can maybe see a little of that here. The turns of line become kind of sometimes big shifts.
Like you think of how your hair looks, I think of the ends of it.
Yes, yeah. It's a leap, huh?
Mm-hmm.
I like the humility and kind of a humility in here with a lust for what is genuine. I really want to live what is genuine. I want to find out what that is. And in the last stanza, the you, meaning God, I think, is what he's addressing, the deity. You look after the wretched. No wonder you came looking for me. The humility is underscored again. And the ends of things, I think, took us back to that, a couple of the earlier thoughts we had about the end of things, the end of time, the heaven and hell. We talked the other day about how a huge portion of great poetry has to do with death
and the life and death struggle, the life and death interplay, and the way it leads us to that finality. And it was Dylan Thomas that said all the really true themes in literature are about death and life. It's kind of at the bottom of it. We go to the top poem on that same page, if you will, Brook Horvath, The End of Modernism. I think of the term disintegration and kind of junk and detritus and some of that stuff that we've been talking about while I read this, if you could. She kind of does some mixing of imagery here. The sky hangs black in the pot's dark pool. I turn to offer you a cup, but you say you've had enough of stars. Dawn, ice, and sawed limbs strewn across the floor of morning, frozen ripples where angels disappear into the brine. Why all this laughter amid so much debris? Your letters never explained, and helpless above the sink, I can only continue scrubbing these lines until they shine like some angel's wave-washed face, but chipped and crazed. Down where the sky pours sympathetically into its cup, someone is singing about the hangman's beautiful daughter, causing the choke cherry to sag, then break into pieces that sparkle like stars, like sea foam, like dishwater, that scatter like notes across this ancient kitchen floor. What do you notice in there about castaways or stuff or junk? Even a word.
Well, we get the sawed limbs strewn across the floor of the morning, mm-hmm. The debris in the next paragraph,
right.
And the scrubbing these lines, mm-hmm. And they still end up chipped and crazed. I mean, it's
right.
Something
that's
imperfect anyway.
Wave washed face, maybe it's erosion or weather beaten.
Mm-hmm.
Seems like a series of collisions, of contradictions,
mm-hmm.
And out of each one something new is born.
Yeah. In the middle, I guess there's in the middle, in the third stanza, or prose poem, if you call them stanzas, becomes relational too, I think. Your letters never explained. This is the one we read yesterday about the two versions. The one that wanted more in the relationship and the one that just liked it the way it was, maybe, if you were, some of you were here.
Same author.
Yeah. So I think you can almost see a connection to that poem even, possibly. Who knows? But scrubbing these lines, you get a picture of the poet at work almost like a metallurgist that's polishing something, or a potter that's scraping away to get the piece ready. I like the way she blends the holy or the more sublime, I guess is a better word, the more sublime with the more mundane, like the, where is it? Kitchen floor.
Yeah.
Dishwater, sea foam.
It's like stars, sea foam, and dishwater.
Mm-hmm. Some of her word choices are beautiful, just on their own too, the choke cherry and the hangman's beautiful daughter, chipped and crazed. I like the way she lathes these lines. There's something about the way she does that too that I think puts them into a kind of a oneness where that, that would be a perceived oneness if it happens in our imagination, right? Whereas otherwise they're separate things. the way we talked about how you perceive something, if you find things and you combine them, that's what creativity is. I think it was Augustine, was it, who called our creation the eighth day of creation? Is that, somebody remember that? I think it was Augustine, where the 7 days, the 6 days of creation, the day that God rested, the 7 biblical days of that story, of that that journey to create, that process, that all things were made, and then as human beings, our creative task is on the eighth day, that we take the stuff of creation and recreate. So it's always recreation for us, combining things that already existed, right? So there really isn't anything new under the sun, like they say, the wisdom says in Proverbs, but we can create all these new things from what pre-existed. So we are recreators instead of the creator's task of primal creation. Let's go skip down a couple. We're going to take a little jump here, but on your own, if you're interested, if the poem is a fascinating poem, but it's far too long for us to get at today, Late Epistle. If you're into this Scott Cairns at all, he takes a really creative and amazing look at the Book of Timothy. So this is what I was saying about why I find one thing very intriguing about him is that he's not afraid to write about Christian subjects. He takes the Epistle of Timothy and basically kind of writes a response. I bumped into this and I hadn't read Timothy for a long time, so it took me back to Timothy. And I thought, wow, he really expanded Timothy for me. And not just that, but I think just to give you a little, something to measure it with, look at, in this poem, if you read it, look at the refining fires of doubt. It's really about doubt versus certainty. What is certainty, what is doubt, and what is the role of doubt in our refining and our growth in faith? And I think he's really saying that it's essential, that to not doubt is to almost be dead, or to be dead, deadly content, maybe. So try that on your own. It's a long poem. It's almost as long as Timothy, maybe a little longer. And let's go to, flip down a little more, we're going to go to Seamus Heaney, toward the back. I like this one partly because my wife is a ceramics teacher as well. She's a painter first, but in her job that she's been at the high school, they asked her to do pottery and ceramics too, and she became a good potter in doing that. Kind of took it on as, yeah, I'll do it. But she's just some amazing things on the wheel too. And even, again, more so, is the reading we read last night that we heard about the potter from Isaiah. Anybody remember that, Vespers? A beautiful reading. I want to know which translation that was because it seemed so fresh to me. But here's another version of the potter. Somebody want to read this? Anybody? Quieter group today. I'll read it. To a Dutch potter in Ireland. Then I entered a strong room of vocabulary where words like urns that had come through the fire stood in their bone dry alcoves next a kiln, and came away changed like a guard who'd seen the stone move in a diamond blaze of air, or the gates of horn behind the gates of clay. The soils I knew ran dirty. River sand was the one clean thing that stayed itself in that slabbery, clabbery, wintry, puddled ground. Until I found Ban clay, like wet daylight or viscous satin under the felt and frieze of humus layers.
the true diatomite discovered in a little sucky hole. Gray blue, dull shining, sticky, touchable, like the earth's old ointment box, scentless and cool. At that stage, you were swimming in the sea or running from it, luminous with plankton, a nymph of phosphor by the Norder Zee, a vestal of the goddess Silica, she who is under grass and glass and ash in the fiery heartlands of Ceramica. We might have known each other then in that cold gleam life underground and off the water, weird twins of puddle, paddle, pit-a-pat, and might have done the small forbidden things, worked at mud pies or gone too high on swings, played secrets in the hedge or touching tongues, but did not in the terrible event, night after night instead in the Netherlands, you watched the bombers kill, then heaven sent, came back lit from the fire a second time, and ever after, every blessed time, through glazes of fired quartz and iron and lime. And if glazes, as you say, bring down the sun, your potter's wheel is bringing up the earth. Hosanna ex infernus, burning wells. Hosanna in clean sand and kaolin. And now that the rye crop waves beside the ruins, in ash pits, oxides, shards, and chlorophylls. It covers a lot of ground. Get some World War II action in there. Takes you a little bit back into some kind of eras in time when these clays were forming, I think. There's a person it's addressed to, right? Anything you like about this, let's start with that. Just anything at all.
Okay.
Go.
As a potter, I think that I probably read it and see it differently in that when they switch from the river sand is the only thing that stays as you work and work the clay. If you overwork it, everything else is so soft it falls away and you get this very gritty surface. And then she moves down into the porcelain clay that has no grit in it. It's and the finer the porcelain, the more translucent it becomes when you fire it. And then a lot of these other properties are tools used to create different effects in the kiln. And the kiln is actually a kiln. So you don't necessarily pronounce the N. So I read it a little bit differently, knowing those things.
You know, you watch the bomber's kill, it suggests
that
heat of
the kill.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then in the Netherlands, I immediately thought of blueware. It's some of the finest during that time, also during World War II, some of the finest porcelain and true blue glaze ever made. And so there's this fine thing being made during the time of this death.
Is BAM clay a particular?
I looked that up. I couldn't find it. I'm presuming it's some certain geographical area where clay comes from.
Yeah.
Which is usually how clays are
named.
Yeah. But these other words, the Vestal is a little more known, but a Vestal virgin, for example, would be a sacred or pure or a chaste. So this Vestal goddess, or is a pure or sacred goddess from Silica, which is silicone comes from, right? But it's a Is it Greek island or Roman? It's from Roman mythology, is what the dictionary told me. Ceramica, the same way, is a, one of the gods, the Roman gods of this art. I had never known that.
That was a made-up word.
For us, silica is ground glass.
Okay.
It's a powdered glass.
Yeah, there you go. That makes more sense.
That is very, it's probably one of the most dangerous properties.
Yeah,
because if you breathe it in, it destroys your lungs. Mm.
I like the, he brings in the hosannas at the end too. I think that's cool. Seamus Heaney is a very well-known poet from Ireland and would be a Catholic faithful person, but you don't see a lot of religious allusions in his work. But here it is, the last two stanzas. Hosanna ex infernus, praise out of the fire. Burning wells, bring down the sun, glazes, and almost like the lights and the colors and the drama of this glaze is so strong that the sun just wants to make love to it and dive in, you know, here you go. And Hosanna in clean sand and kale and more fluid.
Yeah,
it is. The mud pies kind of show up. kids doing their pottery, maybe not. There's something that I would like to ask him about if I could sit down over a cup of coffee with him and ask, you know, where there seems like something healing in here for you. I'd like to know more about, not just because our theme is healing for the summer, but, you know, this relationship. It makes me want to know more about that. And I think I can kind of latch on to the other things, but there's some secrets here that are touched on at the top of the second page, the forbidden things, the secret things in the hedge and touching tongues, some of those childhood experimentation moments of whether that's sexuality or just one's humanity and one's fears and all those different things that at some point in life you to test. Put your toe in those waters, you know. Am I gonna die? What's gonna happen? Maybe nothing, right?
So I like the, also the thing about the Hosanna in the Infernus, because you know we're used to a Hosanna in the highest, and
yeah.
Hosanna in the Inferno.
Yeah, absolutely. That's beautiful. I can't help but when it's in Latin too, like that. Think of Dante, Inferno, maybe. You know?
Yeah.
The hell and heaven. Meeting of the two, the sacred.
And then when I read it, I think of the fire, everything that you make in pottery, if you do not put it into fire, it will never become what it should be, and it'll fall apart.
Mm-hmm.
It never will stay stable. It'll never become stabilized. It takes fire.
Fire
gives it its life.
Mm. The refiner's fire.
Yeah.
I'm glad you were here. She couldn't be here the last couple times. Let's try to finish with Rumi, two pages down. There are four pieces of Rumi poems here. We saw a little bit of his the other day, a Sufi poet from the 13th century. It always cracks me up how medieval historians, which medieval, I guess, technically denotes Europe, have often called 13th the greatest of centuries. There's that phrase in medieval history that the 13th was the greatest. Hot debates ensue, I'm sure, in very few places, but here and there. But even in the Muslim and Arabic cultures of that era, it was a lot of flowering of culture and religion and poetry, too. So, if I could get, I'll read the first one, if somebody wants to read the second, 1616.
I'll read it.
It's less risky. Okay, and then Dean, the third one, please, which is 1359. And is there a pilot in the house who wants to read 747? Okay, bad joke. Anybody? I'll read the last one.
These are numbered.
Just as a lot of his work. Yep, they're just like Bach Verica. Out beyond ideas of wrongdoing and rightdoing, there is a field. I'll meet you there. When the soul lies down in that grass, the world is too full to talk about. Ideas, language, even the phrase each other doesn't make any sense.
Inside the great mystery that is, we don't really own anything. What is this competition we feel then, before we go one at a time through the same gate?
Do you think I know what I'm doing? That for one breath or half breath, I belong to myself? As much as a pen knows what it's writing, or the ball can guess where it's going next.
There's a strange frenzy in my head of birds flying, each particle circulating on its own. Is the one I love everywhere? I'd like to end with this one. And then if you get time to study some of these, including that Timothy one, I think the third, the one that Dean read, connects to the Timothy epistle to about doubt and certainty and knowing and who am I and all that, how small that who am I gets. The disintegration and the burning in the last one, in number 747. Disintegration yields to this, that the love of God is everywhere, and that the power of the Creator is so imbued in, even in the trash, even in the beds of all these types of beds we go through in our journey. So I thank you for being here today, and this is the final. I brought a stack. I have 12 copies of some of my poems. If you want to grab one, you can. I'm not going to be so brave and brazen as to hand them out. So if you wish a copy of some, these are just, I tried to find some recent things. So I always throw in these disclaimers about my own poetry because I'm not that awful keen on it myself. But I would like to invite you to read them and works in progress. But yes, Dean.
I've been out hiking all week. Do you have other stuff like this?
I do. If you would like, I'll get you the four others that we did.
Great.
Yeah.
And are you going to be here next week?